Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Bring Out the Best Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Wright, and our guest today is John Davidoff. He's a leader and networker and relationship manager extraordinaire, and that's what we're going to be talking about today is leadership, establishing high-quality relationships, leveraging those relationships, and we have to go right into the story you were telling me.
Well, I was just telling Bob, I held an event for my company, Davidoff Communications, yesterday, and it's called Mission Drivers Talk. We interview people who are drivers of mission out in life, and the gentleman we had yesterday is a guy named Alan Miller. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, 21 years with the L.A. Times. He's transitioned to become a nonprofit executive. He has an organization called the News Literacy Project, and they train high school students all across the country in what authentic journalism is versus everything else high school students see online. Very, very important. And so we're at the very beginning of the interview, and he starts talking about being a kid going to summer camp in upstate New York in the Adirondacks. And I immediately get hooked because I'd not heard this story from him before, and I'm thinking, well, there's really only one camp that I know about that has even a journalism program, and so I ask him, was it Camp Paradox? And he's like, how do you know Camp Paradox? I'm like, my father and my uncle went to this camp. It no longer exists. My brother went to this camp and won the first Abe Rosenthal Journalism Award. Abe Rosenthal was the managing editor of the New York Times, and sent him my brother a whole story. Anyway, it's an amazing small world story, and then there were other people from that era. And you know, the world just gets smaller.
And it turns out that he, your brother, and another friend of yours were all there at the same time.
Yeah. The third gentleman, John Schreiber, who I met when I was 12, 1972. I got reunited with John in the mid-90s through business work, and someone said, we're going to New York to have a meeting on a project we were working on. And at the end of the meeting, John looks at me and says, by the way, do you know a Doug Davidoff? And I'm like, yeah, and are you John Schreiber from Camp Paradox? And so it's just, you know, it's very, very interesting and humbling. And you know that my life is really devoted to people, to supporting people to be mission drivers, and which for me is living purposeful lives and leading purposeful projects, and really being conscious about values, about vision, what we want to accomplish, kind of how we go about conducting ourselves and leading our organizations. And one of the things I like about this networking, that even with yesterday's story, is that I keep finding like-minded people, people who share my values, people who are themselves have made some decisions in life. Sometimes it's career changes. It might be relationship changes. They've devoted a chunk of who they are. They've made sacrifices. They're at risk in a lot of different ways, and it's very moving. I mean, the small world story is kind of fun, but the alignment with other people, which is something you've helped me on for years, is the sense of aligning with people around mission, around what truth is for us, about what we value. I mean, it's just very energizing, and it's comforting because I feel less alone in the world as I make these relationships.
So you're talking about like-minded people, you're talking about mission, and we're talking about relationships. So tell us more about that and your leadership and how they go together.
Well, when I started I hung my own shingle in 2005. I had a background in big advertising agencies, working with large marketing clients, the Anheuser-Busch's of the world, the State Farm Insurance, Discover Cards, and I had been in and out of the corporate hallways for many years, 20 some odd years. And I am a child of entrepreneurs. I'm a son-in-law of entrepreneurs. And so it was kind of in my DNA, I guess, to hang my own shingle, and it's kind of what I know to do. And I was a couple years into it, and you and I were talking, and you said, you know, you realize you have your own approach to how you do marketing and strategy. And I said, well, what are you talking about? I said, well, you've talked for years about mission-driven strategy and mission-driven marketing. And it's really out of that that I really developed a firm methodology and branded it, and have shared a lot about it with in the different sectors of the world that we work in, with businesses and some nonprofit organizations and associations. But I have found that you draw people towards you. People find you who these themes resonate with them as well as with us. So
and then the missions interact with each other,
yes,
and give each other a boost.
Yeah. I mean, we've had some really, in my mind, prestigious organizations that I've been very honored to work with. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, kind of PETA, you know, kind of a rebel rouser out in the world, because they're master brand marketers. But they're very humble and very decent people behind the scenes at their corporate offices. And, you know, they got referred to us, and after we had a couple meetings, they said, John, there's a way that you've heard what we're trying to do and played it back to us that the other firms we've talked to have not done. And I felt very honored and affirmed by that, but also kind of surprised. But it also tells me that we have developed some skills in listening and helping organizations. Our work is about helping organizations get from A to B. You know, I'm at A, and I either want to grow my organization, or I want to add a new product line, or I want to develop a new base of donors or something. And our clients come to us, and they don't know how to do it. They don't have the skill set on staff. They don't have the bench on staff. For whatever reason, they don't think like this. And so I've really, through being a business owner, come to appreciate skills that I didn't realize had some uniqueness to them.
Well, so we've got relationship, leadership, we've got mission, we've got aligning missions, we've got the capacity to appreciate another's mission, we've got the capacity to align with and support that other person's mission. So these are all really important leadership skills. Mm-hmm. But let's have our first caller and see what you've got to say to him. It's Gene. I'm a sales director that is leading my 100-person organization to develop a sales culture to focus on the customer, pitch larger deals, and get off autopilot. In years past, business just fell in our laps. Not so anymore. Few of my colleagues outside the sales team have any sales training. Where do I begin? Well, Gene, tell us a little bit more about that.
Thank you so much, Bob. So I've been at my company for 7 years, and I've been in the sales role for a number of years. And, you know, I work with some of the smartest people in our industry. I work with people who know how to develop our products, know how to develop our services. And in the past, it was very easy for us to just develop a product or develop a service that would appeal to clients that just came our way. And now, for really the first time in many ways, we're having to go after new clients. We're having to really actively develop lines of business we've never developed before. And so we've got a sales team, and I've talked actually quite extensively with John about this. But we've got a sales team that, you know, is really stepping it up, really seeking new meetings, really looking to build our networks, looking to build our company's networks, and really reach out into the community beyond where we've gone before. But then on the service side, on the actual service delivery side, it's been much more difficult to really get them to think outside the box, to really start growing and really providing what our new clients are going to need I know I'm talking in very general terms just because we're in the midst of a lot of transition.
You've teed up a number of different challenges. I'm going to turn John loose on you, then I'll probably add my 2 cents.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jean. I've spent the last 4 or 5 years writing and talking publicly and working with our clients on what I felt the gift of the recent economic downturn was. And I actually had a title of a talk I gave called Mission-Driven Marketing for Post-Recessionary Times. Because I felt and still feel that...
So she's not the only one whose business isn't falling in her lap anymore.
No. The world changed. We went through a deep 4-year recession. And now I'm going to get into a little political thing. Some people, declare the recession's over. I think if you look at unemployment rates and the housing market and the job market and a lot of other economic indicators, I don't know that life is all that different than it was when we were in the heart of the recession. And particularly concerned about the growing disparity in income and equality issues. But we don't need to get into that here. What the implications are for leaders is that the world has changed, and how we all led our organizations before the banking crisis at the end of 2008 and going into 2009 is very different than what it is today. And in my opinion, we're not going back. If there's organizations that were just trying to ride this out, they missed the gift of the recession, which was the gift of the recession was we all needed to look and see how we needed to transform. So now I'm in your area.
And mission is going to be central to this,
I suppose. Because we first start with our mission. We never walk away from our mission when we are under internal threats, people coming and going in our organizations, external threats, economic conditions, job market, political changes in political leadership, the environment, I mean, all sorts of things that affect the projects we're leading, depending on what they are. And we must always first come back to our mission. We literally, in our organization, recite our mission every Monday morning as a staff. And we
at the beginning of staff meetings.
And I love Monday mornings because it centers me. And I'm reminded why we're going to go through what we're going to go through this coming week. Because the weeks are going to be stressful. There's going to be tension. There's going to be multiple things we need to get done in a finite amount of time and resources and all that. But I just find when I come back to that mission, it just informs me as to why we're doing what we're doing, and we can even be excited about what we're doing amidst all the challenges.
So if we apply this to Gene. Gene is going to need to make sure everybody is clear on the mission.
Yep.
And that the mission drives every interaction with a client.
Yep.
And that they're looking with clients at new ways to fulfill the client's mission, their organization's mission, and come up with creative responses.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of your first bit of homework, Gene, is to do that. So once she's gotten the mission clarified with her people. And Jean, I think it starts at how you hire, how you train, and who you fire. And we like to talk about it, whom you liberate to go find some place that is more aligned with their mission so they don't drag down your mission, because every person who's not mission-oriented in your organization, and we're not just talking lip service, is actually taking away from the mission.
And it's the biggest favor you can do for them, because they're not in sync for a variety of ways. So everyone wins when you make those hard decisions. And they don't even need to be hard decisions.
So one of the things Jean's going to be able to do is to train her people to talk to their potential clients
mm-hmm.
about mission
mm-hmm.
and what her organization can do to fulfill their mission. And that's going to generate creative new responses, which is part of the transformation into their next way of being.
Very much so. And I think in a lot of industries, I imagine in Jean's as well, a lot of life was transactional. I want to sell you this, or I can do you this, and you'll pay me that, and that sort of thing. But it's interesting with the new media and the technology, you know, the handheld devices, and, you know, a lot of people don't even need laptops anymore. They just work off of phones and tablets. And then with all the social media, the way we're connected on Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter, and there's a different flow and exchange of information. And I think the way we develop relationships has changed. And, you know, I saw this in the financial services industry with some of our clients who were used to just people walking into retail offices and saying, here's my money, please manage it. And you know, for the first time in their lives, they had to learn how to go to a networking event and how to, you know, what people would say, work a room. I don't really like that. I think, you know, I like the idea of getting to know people and finding out what's important to them and generating some commonalities. But you took a person who spent sometimes 10, 20, 30 years in just a transactional world, and they were very successful. And all of a sudden, you dump them into a relationship world, and an exchange of information and a building of trust and integrity. It's a whole different game. I think it's, in some ways, it's a much more exciting game, and a much, you know, because it's more, for me, it's more meaningful. It stirs thought about what's really important to people and where, you know, again, where we can be aligned around common mission.
So, Gene, you've got your work cut out for you. I hope that helps.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm seeing more concretely just how much we need to bring everyone to the table and talk about what is our mission, what is it we're trying to accomplish, and keep this conversation going.
Well, and what is the mission of everyone you talk to, everyone they interact with, every project they do? How do they assess that mission? How do they confirm that they're apprehending that mission? And then how do they help create new ways to fulfill that mission that are aligned with your mission?
That's great. That's different than we've talked about it before.
Okay, well, go get them, and you've got a skill set your people need to have, which is to help drive the mission of your clients and do that into new products and services. Thanks very much, and we wish you all the best, Gene.
Thank you both.
Bye-bye. Okay, so we've got a challenge. Gene's right in line with what you're talking about. Let's go to Kirsten. Kirsten says, how do I deal with the one person that has the need to challenge either an authority or new agreements in front of the whole group?
Ooh.
Well, there you go.
Yes, hi. Thanks, Bob and David. Yeah, so I work as a business coach, and I often facilitate culture change in organizations. And that could mean that there is a mission existing, that there are core values already in place, or not. And so I either will focus the whole group into really operating from mission and values, or we will introduce a new mission and new core values. And it never fails that there's always one person who likes to go across the stream. And John, you talked a little bit about that in your previous conversation. And I would like to get some feedback on how can I don't want to expose that person and sort of embarrass them in front of the group. And at the same time, how do I support the person that's leading? It could be a business owner, it could be a manager, to really be focused and strong and show up focused.
Well, I have a perspective, because when Bob was first reading your story, I kind of jumped to making this individual the bad guy. But a lot of times that individual is not the bad guy. That's actually the individual who's sitting on a piece of truth about the organization's situation, or something that's bugging them, and maybe they're not the most articulate person about how they share it and are the most responsible in their communication, but I look for what is that nugget of truth about the situation that they've got a bug about that maybe does need to be brought into the room in a safe way, in a responsible way, that where people aren't under attack or ever, but usually there is something in there that does need to be addressed, and if you can find it and bring it out, you can oftentimes create a conversation that's long overdue, and it's, you know, sort of the elephant in the room or the thing that never really gets talked about, and it's actually hindering the organization from being completely on mission.
So absolutely, and the thing I would add to that is I like to defend against that kind of thing before it ever happens. And one of the ways I like to do that is to have ground rules in a meeting that you don't get to come up with a problem without it being responsible for the solution to it. And the other piece that we really like is when somebody is at odds, we like to talk about what's your ideal state. You don't get to have just a criticism without saying what your ideal state is, and then be open to discuss other people's ideal state, which includes their mission statement, until we can get everybody aligned. And when someone has to do that, then it's much easier to come up with pathways, and it's much safer to look at what present-day problems are, because we are all aimed at an ideal solution we're headed towards. So I start out with ground rules. Then as things come up, immediately ask them, is this our present state problem? Is this a pathway to an ideal state? Or is it an ideal state, which includes mission? And then we hold them accountable to be constructive. And that helps us what John's talking about.
And then if you want to take it to the advanced level, and we learned this through our work at Wright, you can add an agreement called no blame and no shame and no justification in how the issue on the table is getting dealt with. That really, in some ways, divides the adults from the kids, the men from the boys, because that really elevates the level of responsibility in the room to focus on the organization, to focus on the mission, and not to personalize the situation or make it about any one individual. And that also can really advance the level of creativity and problem solving, to sort of bring everyone more together than sort of be the divide that sort of, you know, keeps people separate.
So, does that give you something to work with, Kirsten?
Oh, it's great. Thank you so much to both of you. Yes, that definitely gives me, and it was a good reminder to use some tools in my toolbox that I haven't used lately. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, okay, so well, that's I love the way you put that together, because we want to really use the full information about the system to fulfill mission. And so that's great. So our next caller is David. He says, what do I do with reactive factions? So, David, tell us about that.
Well, I'm a shareholder company, and there's a bunch of us, probably about 200, that are in my lane group. And my perspective, participant group is twofold.
Hey, David, we're having a hard time hearing you.
Is this better?
There we go.
Better?
Yeah, I hear you now. Yes.
Okay. I'm a shareholder in a company, and there's about 200 of my other shareholders in online. And from my perspective, this is a group of twofold. One is to share information and keep everybody up to date on, you know, major things that are happening with the company. And secondly, to come up with maybe some new ideas for the management that might help them. And the first two that I was
So, David, I'm sorry, we are not able to decipher what you're saying. We've got a bad connection, and George doesn't seem to be able to get it any better. Would it help if David were to call back in?
Why don't I try my other phone?
Oh, okay, that would be great.
Okay, I'll call right back in.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah.
So what I did get is that he's got a company of 200 shareholders. He's a shareholder in it. And I couldn't follow the rest of what's going on with reactivity.
No. Can you hear me now?
I heard you very faintly, David.
These are my only two phones, so I'm sorry about this. I got my landline and I've got my cell phone.
Okay, well, why don't you keep going? I could understand that. It's very hard, but let's give it a shot.
Okay. Well, the problem from my perspective is that these two guys dominate the group because everybody, for the most part, is scared to speak up. And they sling a lot of mud at the chairman, which to me is hostile and irresponsible.
Two guys dominate the group, and they do what that's hostile?
They sling mud at the chairman.
Swing a lot at the chairman?
Oh, they swing at the chairman. Okay.
Yeah, mud. You know, and the chairman actually is an excellent leader. He's done a great job.
Okay.
And so, after a year, I decided to finally start speaking up and taking them on.
Okay,
I'm looking for different ways that I can increase my influence with the people in the group.
Okay.
So we'll start listening to, you know, what makes sense as opposed to just very fast and reactive communication.
Okay, great. So it's pretty clear these guys are being irresponsible in what they're saying. And so what is I'm getting out of this so far is that there aren't clear ground rules about what is responsible interaction in a meeting. And for us, this gets back to what I was saying to Kirsten earlier, which is, that we need to have ground rules, and one of the ground rules is you don't get to talk about a complaint without having a solution that you're bringing about. A criticism without a personally responsible action is just blame, shame, or justification. And Mr. Deming, the man who really helped the Japanese recover from World War II, he's regarded as a business saint over there, said that blame, shame, and justification don't lead to change 96% of the time. So part of what I would look to do is to talk about how the meetings should be carried on and how the organization is going to operate. And then you asked another question that I couldn't understand fully, which was, how do you increase your influence in a way that supports the CEO? Was that your question, David?
Part of it, interesting, more influence with the whole group.
Okay, with the whole group, right.
So I want to ask you, Bob, because this is a complex situation, and I think you work more in public companies than I do, but you know, this is not an unusual situation, public or private, to have some unhappy shareholders. And a lot of times those unhappy shareholders have built up a large number of shares and have big voices or seats at the table or whatever. And so, yeah, I think there's an appropriate way to respond. But sometimes there's also the system that's in play. And sometimes those rebel shareholders, again, are playing a role in the system that actually is healthy and needs to be played out.
Right. So one of the things David can do is to say, okay, I hear your criticism, I hear your complaint, what's the positive direction you want this to go towards?
Mm-hmm.
So that David can speak up and say, help me understand where you're going with this and
right.
what you think we need to do.
This was, back to our PETA client, you know, I got to hear them strategize up close and personal a lot of times, but, you know, it wasn't beyond them to go to a shareholder meeting of, you know, McDonald's Corporation and sabotage the meeting. In the middle of the meeting, someone would literally push the speaker aside from the lectern and make a statement about treatment of animals in front of the whole shareholders.
Okay.
They might get escorted off the stage by security, but darn, they felt a need to have a point of view about treatment of animals that they felt the company was not taking. And I always had mixed feelings. I was like, I was upset, like, oh, you kind of broke mom's rules. Dad's going to get mad. That wasn't really the right way to handle things. But then I kind of admired it. It was like, wow, totally disruptive. Went for, you know, a point of view that you wanted to get out on the table. Wasn't really the rules, didn't really play by the rules, but kind of creative and got your needs met.
Okay. Is that what they're doing, David?
Unfortunately, no. They're just attempts to make outrageous, unfounded allegations.
Oh, I got it. So they're taking opinions they have about something that are not founded and attacking. Well, that sounds like a request for information. How are those allegations dealt with?
Well, until I started speaking up, they really weren't. People would just agree with them. And it's really, they're really amounting to personal attacks.
Okay. So, these people aren't really interested in the facts? They don't listen when they're corrected?
I think they just want to have power and be the big kahuna. I think they probably have authority issues. They want to be the ones in charge, regardless of the consequences.
Okay. And so you want to intervene, so to what end in these meetings? So this is really a personal challenge for you.
Well, I want to support the CEO. I think he's making all the right moves, and I want to see the exchange grow, and so the price of the stock's going to go up. I don't want us to be undermined by this type of hostile, reactive behavior, which will be destructive to the organization and company.
Okay, so you think they're actually potentially hurting the company. And when you ask them for the basis for these allegations in the meeting, what do they say?
Well, I reply, we don't meet in person, it's all online, but when I call them out, typically, they don't respond to me.
I couldn't understand.
They don't respond to him when he, I think.
Okay, when you ask, they don't respond.
Which is part of their approach. They only talk publicly.
And if there are only 2 out of 200 shareholders, how much influence are they able to have?
Well, they have their followers. They may not speak up, but they have their followers.
We couldn't follow you on that one. I'll tell you though that I recently was working with the head of a membership organization that numbers its members in the tens of thousands, and it actually goes closer to the hundreds of thousands when you figure that this particular organization represents 4 other organizations too. And each of the other organizations had 2 seats on their board of directors. And, in fact, what was going on is 2 of the board members from one of the other organizations were sabotaging the effectiveness of my client's organization. And it took a lot of strategizing and 2 rounds of actions to vote them off. And there is a point when people are being bad citizens that you offer to buy them out. If they're so unhappy, then the logical thing to do is to say, look, you're very unhappy.
We're all happy. We aren't voting to replace the CEO. Let's look at buying your shares out so you can go somewhere where you'll be happier and we won't have to listen to groundless allegations.
Okay. I don't think, they're on the airline group. I could talk to the guy who runs the group and suggest they kick him off the group, but I don't think it would be out of place to ask them to sell their shares. That's their own personal business.
He's going to talk to the person who kind of heads up this group, but he doesn't think they're going to be motivated to share their sell their shares.
Well, then you've got to ask them why they're staying around. So at any rate, thank you very much, David, and we wish you the best with it.
Good luck.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks, Jordan.
Yeah, that's a fantastic leadership challenge at the owner level of a public company. And so our next person is Art, and he says, what do I do with my anger when I feel like I'm being put off? So Art, talk to us.
Well, one of my big upsets for years and years is walking into a store, you know, to buy something, and somebody... No, just being ignored. And, you know, I want to say, hey, I'm a customer. Get over here and talk to me. And, you know, I just start building up a little anger. And by the time somebody comes over, I want to, you know, get really pissed off at them. But I try to hold it back. And I don't feel
good. Okay. So, John,
this feels like more your area.
So it's really a personal challenge, isn't it? How do we feel more whole and complete? And you sound like you're fairly advanced in years, and I kind of like being the old man because I can say, young lady, I've been standing here for 5 minutes, and you haven't even acknowledged my existence. Can you help me understand the strategy in that? Now, it depends on how much you want to put somebody in on the hot seat. You can also say, you know, I've been standing here for 5 minutes, and you haven't seemed to be dealing with an avalanche of demand. And you're just now getting over here. I'd like you to know that I'm really quite offended.
Aha! Uh-huh. I think that sounds good. You know, my general response is that I probably show anger in what I'm saying, but I don't say the thing that I really feel, and I sort of back off.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting
because what you're saying is really a perfect way for me to deal with that.
Well, I like it too because the first way you suggested, Bob, was I felt like it was going to put Art in sort of where he'd just be written off as the old cranky,
sometimes
man.
It's sweet
and still nice. But the second way, and there's not a right way here. So it's what's going to be the most satisfying to Art,
right?
Way, but the second way did actually, it sounds like, put you, Art, more in rapport with the person behind the counter who just, you know, may not even be aware of your experience and would be happy to respond to whatever you say to her that says, hey, could you help me? Are you aware that I've been standing here for 5 minutes and you've paid no attention to me?
Yeah,
well, you know, the thing that comes up for me when you say that is that very often I assume that they are thinking what I think they're thinking. And when I think about it, very often they're not. You know, they may be distracted with something else, or they may be working on something else, and I make up a story that they're just not wanting to pay attention to me.
See, I keep thinking of years ago, my wife and my boys and I were on the security line at LaGuardia Airport, waiting to, you know, where the guy checks your ID and your boarding mm-hmm. pass so you can go through the X-ray and stuff. And the guy had made a switch from one line to the other line, and then, you know, other people were passing us by because, sort of like the grocery store thing, we kept ending up in the line that wasn't moving. And I was increasingly irritated because he did not realize that people were passing us by. And by the time I had a chance to have a few words with him, you know, and so I got my authority issues going, and this is the TSA guy, and he's got his little, I won't be condescending, but he's got his uniform, and he's got the podium or the lectern, and, you know. But he and I got into it a little bit, and so I wanted to see, you know, I knew there was a line where I couldn't cross or I could put myself in some sort of legal jeopardy, and I didn't. And at the same time, I wanted to model for my kids a responsible way to express my upset. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember all the details, but my kids do remember that at one point I told him that I thought he had anger management issues, which they let me forget, and I don't think they'll follow that as a model of how to deal with people.
So you tweaked the nose of the tiger, and then
yes.
you said, gee, you're a tiger. Okay, well, that's fun. Thanks a lot, Art.
You're welcome.
So our next caller is Jin, and she says, how do I become a leader at work? So tell us about it, Jin.
Hello, can you hear me, Bob?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. So I'm working for a big bank. There are just so many people, thousands of some people here. And I often feel I'm not being seen. And then I feel like I do have potential to be a lead at work, but I just don't know how to reach to my goal.
Okay, great. Well, you're right in John's wheelhouse, so let's hear what he's got to say.
Well, I'd want to hear a little bit more about what feeling seen actually looks like to you.
So right now I'm working in a group. I work like as a business analyst. What I observed when
you're working in a small cube most of the day, not really interacting with people. Is that a large part of the environment you work in?
Yes, correct.
You're kind of on your own all day in probably a windowless environment.
Yes.
Okay, keep going.
When I joined the company, I just suddenly noticed all these people around me, they work in the same position for 10, 20, 30 years and then retire. And I always keep wondering just how to go up. It seems everybody just stay in the same spot for so long, maybe just feeling so comfortable. Maybe I should just take more risk, reach out to people, you know, to be seen. Maybe I should join more group, you know, like women's group or Asians group, and then just start from there to be a lead at those groups first, and then come back to my work, you know, trying to do the same thing. I just sort of feel lost. I have so many ideas, but don't know which way to go. And I also heard people tell me I need to hook up to a strong leg, you know, and then when they get promoted, I get up too.
Well, Bob's right. I do resonate with this very much. So I spent 12 years in an advertising agency with about 800 employees, and I was on one account, and I had very limited exposure. I worked with a team of 5 or 10 people, but I felt sort of bad, and I didn't really feel seen or acknowledged, or a lot of ways I kind of created myself as a victim. And then, you know, in large part, working closely with Bob during that employment at that company, I really came to understand that this business was like a candy store for me, and that was full of all these people that I could learn from, and that I could create relationships with, and find ways to volunteer to sort of get myself in other streams. I remember when I went whitewater rafting once, and you fall into the water and you get caught in those cycles. They say the way to get out of the cycle is to put any part of your body in another current, and it'll get you out. I've used that many times when I've been in challenging situations. But at the advertising agency, very similar to your probably your bank situation, I made it a point to try and meet a new person every week, and not just a peer, but I tried to go up one, two, or three levels. And I was in my 20s at the time, and I had a genuine interest in meeting some people who could mentor me. And so I approached people and said, "Hey, could I take you to coffee? Could I get on your lunch calendar? Could I meet you for breakfast? And I'd like to just talk about the industry and your sense of how to manage my career and learn a little bit more about what you do here." And I was totally genuine about it. I really had no other agenda or anything. And I did that for several years. And then a couple years later, the guy who ran one of the big high-profile accounts in the agency requested that I come work on his business. And it came out of nowhere. I had no idea this was in the works. And, boy, did that feel great. And I realized I had done that because I had taken risks to go kind of reach out to him. He had a big corner office. He was a big authority person. And it just felt great. Like, I got myself sort of on his radar while I was off learning. The other thing I did during those years is I looked for ways to volunteer. In the advertising agency business, they're always pitching the next account, and they need people to run errands, to help think things through, to write copy, to whatever. I was happy, and so I spent a lot of nights and weekends with the top executives in the company because I was willing to go grab lunch or go make copies or whatever. But that got me licensed to sit in the conference room for long hours and be at the table with them. So I learned how to develop new business presentations that way. There was one other point which Bob really helped me with over the years with that, and I'm blanking on it, so I'll come back to it. But it was just related to taking risks and seeing where you can help people.
Well, one thing is you started learning how to sell.
Yep.
And then how did you come to have the event marketing for them?
Event marketing was growing as a discipline, so,
concerts. Outside of that agency.
Outside of, yeah, and the company didn't have an event marketing discipline, and I had learned a lot about it in my work, so I went to the president of the advertising agency, and I said I'd like to write a business plan, and I did, and they said, we'd like to go with this. And we'd like to put you in charge. We're going to give you 2 years to figure this out because when you start, you're not going to be tied to any revenue, and that's a very vulnerable place to be. So if you don't get the revenue going, you won't have a job. And so it was kind of an entrepreneurial venture inside a large organization, and we were very successful with it.
And then that got you out in the world, and yep. People started trying to recruit you.
Yes.
So, Chin, I like what you're saying. I like very much what you're saying. And I want to underline, I want to add something, because it sounds like you're thinking similarly to what John is saying.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at joining clubs, meeting people. He talked about meeting a new person a week.
Yep.
So meeting a new person a week is a great thing. But I would focus on the company mission. How is the company doing? And I would talk to people about the company mission, how they feel about what the company's doing. And then the other thing is to let your boss know that you want to be developed. And what are the training programs the organization has that will develop you? Because it sounds like a fairly substantial bank that she's
yeah.
working in.
Yeah. And now I remember the other thing you advised me many years ago when I was at General Growth Properties to the chairmanship of the United Way campaign was open. And so they came and asked me, and I came and talked to Bob. I was like, do you think this is a good use of my time? It's a big responsibility. It's very visible. And so we sorted through the logistics. And this may not be at the level that you would play at something like that, but you might ask to be on a team for a charity that the company supports. Or it's just another way to be aligned with the company's mission, to be helping, to be learning and building relationships. But that was a very important experience. That put me at the table with the CEO of the company, who wanted very much to impress upon the United Way that his company was a player. And in the end, we doubled the annual giving with the company that year. And so the CEO looked great. I got my kudos, and it was a great experience.
Yeah, that's a perfect example of one of the things you can do. And hopefully you'll pick something that fosters your own personal mission as well as the company's mission. And so if we've got you doing that, you do the activities, you let people know you want to develop, that you want more responsibility, and you want to know what the training programs are in the company. And then a lot of people get their companies to pay for them to come and do leadership development with us. And then we ask you to have a leadership development project. So it might be to start a club at work or to join a club, to grow a club. But we want you to have a place where you are looking to take your own influence and expand yourself into greater influence, greater outcomes, greater responsibilities, greater risks. And that causes people to see you doing that, and they start trusting you more.
I want to speak to that, because this has been huge for me for well over 25 years. I have always invested in outside training and coaching for my career, but my employers have all paid a share of that training, and that when they hired me or as they groomed me and promoted me through the organization, they knew that what came with my package as an employee was a commitment to continually develop myself personally and professionally, to keep bringing out my best, to keep identifying strengths, weaknesses, and I've been in this game a long time, and the game of developing myself. And there were job interviews and jobs that I actually got where I was hired. In some ways, it felt like less for my professional skill set and more for my investment in being a leader. And I've talked a lot about the training programs I've done through Wright, and those have often been the focus of job interviews, to really talk to someone about, you know, how much I've invested in learning to build a high-performance team. And not just say the words, but actually have done it and to speak to it. It's very compelling and really sets you apart from other people who are probably, you know, interested in what the job hours are and where can I go in my career here and things like that, which is, you know, you want to kind of know that stuff, but that's not what you want to talk about in an interview.
Yeah, and we've got an event coming up now. It's our summer leadership training event where people work in teams. And one of the ways to get on profile is to talk to your bosses about the training you're doing and to ask them for their goals for you in the training. And if your boss isn't motivated, you talk to your boss's boss. Just make sure that your boss knows that you're doing that and that that's how you're going about developing yourself. But communicating your motivation, what you're learning, asking them for feedback, what would they like to see you get better at, asking them what you need to do to move to the next level. If you don't let them know that you want to move, then they're not going to be able to watch out for you. So how does that sound, Jin?
Yeah, wonderful. So many great ideas.
Okay, well, let us know how it goes. Thanks very much. Good luck.
Thank you.
So, Jin was our last caller. And I would like you to just say what's going through your mind that you would say to people about leadership and relationship in closing, in terms of what you've learned that you think people should know?
Well, thanks. I feel like we've covered a lot, and kind of this has been fun to go back and sort of inventory some of the things that were. I resonated with each caller today. I resonated with sort of wanting to make people the bad guys in a meeting situation, or not feeling seen, or feeling sort of hopeless, or feeling upset, but not knowing how to express that in a way that I think the years of leadership work that I have done and continue to do and will always do is because the level of satisfaction for me in really kind of harnessing myself and being able to continually put myself in more increasingly vulnerable situations. And I'm sure there's leadership quotes about this that the reward for doing good work is more hard work, more challenges, bigger challenges. And I think at some point I kind of caught on to, oh, it's never actually going to get easier. And it's not even that I want it to get easier. It's actually these are the things that keep calling me to step up to the next challenge, to develop myself. And another thing I've worked with you on, Bob, over the years is to be vulnerable in a when I'm sitting across the desk or a restaurant from a CEO or someone who does create authority issues for me, and for me to just sort of go to that place internally and to do a sort and to say, you know what, I have value here, I have things I want to understand, I have ways that I want to serve, and I have ways I want to be served, and to just stay focused on that and put all the caca stuff aside, can handle that another time, and it's been increasingly rewarding. And the thing that I really am amazed at is people really appreciate having someone to talk to who's solid. I find that people with big leadership responsibilities appreciate when someone can sit across from them and actually resonate with the ways they feel at risk, the ways things may be challenging, painful, I don't know what the right word is, or just flat out scary. And there's a way just to sort of be with someone, but you sort of have to kind of learn how to be with those feelings inside of you, because it's not like a fake it or kind of thing. It's a really genuine thing. And I think the people that I've seen that I've done leadership training with here at Wright, who've really, they come back week after week after week, and they keep turning in and going deeper to themselves. I watch their careers. They're inspiring to me. They keep me inspired to go back out every day and do the personal development work I need to do so I can be there for our clients.
So what part of what you're saying is when you say people of influence want to talk to someone solid, say that being solid means that you are with yourself in such a way that you notice your own sadness, your own fear, your own hurt.
Yeah.
You know that they have the same feelings you have.
Yes.
You are being with your own feelings in such a way that it invites them to share with you their experience of the world.
Yes.
And they see you as a substantial human being sharing with them as substantial human beings.
Which is great. I mean, when people start opening up to you and telling you, you realize they're saying things that they don't usually talk about over lunch, and so they can clear their minds. They're kind of figuring, they're working things through, which is what we help people do. We help people get from A to B.
So that's what we're talking about, is relationship and being more deeply in contact with yourself so you can be more deeply in contact with others. And thank you very much, John Davidoff, for all of the fantastic lessons you've shared with us today.
Thanks. It was great, Bob. Thank you.
So bring out the best. Block Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Wright. Join us at www.wrightliving.com/ two free chapters, pick up those two free chapters of our Transform book. Follow us. Let us be your partners in bringing out your best and those around you.